we see self-injury is it's only this particular demographic. It's teenage girls that are this, this, and this. And that's not the case at all. Self-injury starts in elementary school. And it's across all racial groups. It's across all age groups, all financial groups. It is an international epidemic, and that's not an exaggeration.
What can behavioral health providers do to better understand the realities of self-harm and to know how to respond when they spot the signs in their patients? I'm David Kondos, and we'll discuss this with counselor Lori Vann on this episode of Recovery Unscripted.
My addiction doesn't care that I was the son of a former president, doesn't care I'm the son of Betty Ford, doesn't care I was an actor. My addiction is out that door every day waiting for me doing push-ups.
I was ashamed of myself. I didn't love myself, and I wanted to be someone else.
This story that dawned on me one time is about the agony we create in our search for a pain-free life.
I remember my agent saying, okay, you can do this, but that will be career suicide. And I remember thinking, okay, well, as a person in recovery, I have to always choose career suicide over soul suicide.
It was the greatest day of my life, literally, because you find out who you are, you get your life back, and you realize, I'm not living in that hell anymore, and I don't have to.
Sharing firsthand stories and expert insights from the front lines of behavioral and mental health care. This is Recovery Unscripted.
Well, I'm here with Lori Vann. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So let's start with having you tell us a little bit about your story and how you became involved in the world of recovery.
Well, I'm a licensed professional counselor supervisor. I've been working with non-suicidal self-injury for about 20 years now. Stumbled upon it, just started to have one client after another who did it, and that just, you know, kept on going, and it's my real passion. And the more that I've worked with it, the more needs I see out there. And my goal is to try to take a program I've developed, the Self-Injury Prevention Intervention Program, get it into treatment centers on a national and an international level. And the program's based on 4 out of the 5 books that I've written.
And so you were already practicing in psychology, and this is just something you saw, was this self-injury?
Yes. I'm currently in private practice in a suburb of Dallas called Lewisville, and I've been in private practice for a little over 10 years now, but have practiced inpatient psych, nonprofits, outpatient clinics, school district, sort of the whole gamut. And it's just a consistent theme that kept coming up.
Yeah. And so here at the conference, Innovations in Recovery, you gave a presentation, What You Think You Know About Non-Suicidal Self-Injury, and abbreviated NSSI, right?
Correct.
And so you're looking at that kind of versus the reality and how getting it right can make all the difference. And so I guess, first of all, to kind of set the landscape for this, could you give us an intro to what is non-suicidal self-injury and what are some of the myths or misconceptions people have about it?
Well, non-suicidal self-injury, which previously had been referred to as self-mutilation, sometimes erroneously referred to as cutting, you could say self-harm as well. And how I've defined it over the years is pretty simplistic. It's the intentional infliction of harm upon one's body, usually for emotional reasons. And the things to focus in on it are the intentional part, and that's what separates it from suicide. Suicide, the intent is to die. Self-injury, the intent is to harm yourself, to deal with your emotions. It's a perceived coping skill. And some of the myths, because it's a really taboo topic, a lot of people don't even assess for it, unfortunately, especially since there's such a strong correlation with suicide. So I think self-injury should be assessed by everyone, every clinician, every treatment center. But the myths, it's everything from, well, some people think it is a suicide attempt, and it's not. Some people think it's strictly for attention seeking. It's not.
Yeah. And actually, the way you described it, it's very different from suicide. Like,
yes.
The whole motivation and everything is very different.
Yes, the intent really is such a key piece to assess for. And oftentimes, people don't bother to ask. They just assume. And how you would treat a suicide attempt is very different than how you would treat a self-injurious act. Now, there's a very strong correlation that, and I've worked with about 500 cases, consulted on hundreds more, and at least 60% of cases I've worked with have a history of suicidal ideation or an attempt, but one is not a guarantee of the other. Obviously, there are plenty of people that have attempted suicide that never self-harmed. But you do need to assess for both parts, because on self-injury, it can possibly be a predictor of a later suicide attempt. And tons of research I can point to goes with that. But people do think, well, they're just doing it to get attention. And I would say, even if someone did it for getting attention purposes, we really need to step back and have the compassion and really ask ourselves what drove a person to that point where they thought that's the only way they can get attention. To me, that's really a sad state of affairs, that someone got to such a level they felt that was the only way that they could get someone to notice them or to help them is to harm themselves and then to quote unquote show it off.
Yeah. So even if it is that, that's a great example of where the treatment providers can step in and say, okay, this is still a cry for help, and there's reasons behind this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, unfortunately, some people get a little jaded to it, and they might be judgmental, and they might react with sort of a callous way. And I've seen that in some treatment centers where they go, oh, well, what do you expect? I mean, they're just, they're a cutter, or they're a this, or oftentimes it's tied into the diagnosis of borderline of, well, that's just what they do, is to get attention. And you hear a lot of that frustration. My thought is, okay, is that coming out when you're actually meeting with a client? But it's also how judgmental of you and how uneducated of you, because you really don't understand this behavior. And we also, one of the myths is that you have to be borderline if you're self-harming. And that's not the case at all. It's just, unfortunately, in the DSM, one of the very few times self-harm is mentioned is with borderline personality. And I can tell you for a fact that the majority of the cases I've worked with, they're not borderline. And if you work with it, and again, this is about assessment, you catch your young enough age, then you really intervene so that maybe they don't become a full personality disorder.
Yeah. And so you've gotten into this a little bit, but why do people engage in NSSI? It's you say it's like a coping mechanism, so it's similar to substance use, has some overlap with that kind of thing?
Absolutely. The first book that I wrote on, A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury, I've collected 35 reasons why people self-harm. And with that, every time they self-harm, it could be a completely different reason. It's also to note that every time they harm, it could be for multiple reasons. So it could be, well, I was sad, and I was also angry, and I felt like I needed to punish myself. And sometimes it's just a single reason. Everything felt out of control. The number one, by far, the number one reason people self-harm is that the emotional pain is so bad, it's so difficult to deal with, the physical pain's just easier to cope with. It's a distraction. Some people, they get the rush from it, because when you harm yourself, it does release your body's own natural opiates, their own, pain pill, as it were.
As a reaction to the pain.
Yeah. And so people have this escape, this release from it. They don't have to focus on their emotions. It's as if the injury purges it from their body, which is some similarities with eating disorders, too. And it's that part of where I'm really trying to help people in the substance treatment world understand that self-injury, one, should really be seen as an addiction, and two, there's a lot more similarities. With self-injury, that rush lasts about a couple of hours, and then the cycle can start all over again, much like substance use.
Yeah, and then they have to feel like they have to keep coming back to that.
Yes.
You touched on this a little bit earlier. A lot of clinicians kind of feel uncomfortable about this. It's kind of a taboo thing. Why do you feel that the healthcare profession is so unaware or avoidant of this kind of topic?
I think it's just our own personal discomfort because it seems so counterintuitive to do that to one's body. And that's where you get some of the shaming involved where people go, well, you must be crazy. You must be this, you must be that in order to do that to your own body. People avoid pain. You're seeking it out. And right there, it's just, you know, that mindset, and instead of stepping back and go, okay, but again, what's going to cause someone to do this? I think the media is a factor because we've talked a lot more about substance. Substance has become, for lack of a better way to put it, a little bit more socially acceptable. You have celebrities that come out and they talk about their history with addiction. And it's great. It's wonderful where you're having these conversations and awareness. And eating disorders is starting to get a little bit more out there in those discussions because of some celebrities, and it's not getting as shamed as what it used to be. But self-injury is still a huge taboo, and it's just so counterintuitive. It's just hard for us to conceptualize why someone would do that. But if you see self-injury and substance being very similar in nature, substance use is a form of self-harm. I mean, you're ingesting things that are toxic to your body. It's just the scars are internal, so no one sees them.
And even in the moment, like they understand if they're thinking clearly that this is not healthy.
Yes, absolutely.
But the addiction keeps it going. Yeah.
And maybe it's because in, you know, movies and TV, we see so many commercials for substances. We see it throughout movies of people using, and it's just more normalized. And we just don't have that same thing with injury, and we don't want it to be a normalized process. We want it to be seen as, hey, there's help. This isn't the best way to deal with life. And instead of shaming and stigmatizing, it's let's just get those discussions going, much like with suicide. And it's just waiting for people to get on board with that, because it's so much more common than what people realize. And I would say in the U.S., you're looking at about a 20 to 35% lifetime risk.
Really? So 20 to 30% of Americans at some point would be at risk for this?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And when you get into clinical populations, that's where you're really going to see it, in that 30 percentile and above. But there's so many different studies that have come out over the years of, one, I think, goes back to 2006, I think, and it was a university study of students from top universities, and 20% of them, and this was like 10 years ago or more, that it was Columbia and I think maybe Princeton, and about 17 to 20% of their student body had a history of self-harm. I mean, this was a long time ago. You can only imagine what the numbers would be like.
And that's like a high-achieving population.
Yes.
That you would think should be confident and successful and all that, but it's there's still that overlap.
And that's part of some of the myths, too, is that we see self-injury as it's only this particular demographic. It's teenage girls that are this, this, and this. And that's not the case at all. Self-injury starts in elementary school. The Guardian had a study that last year in 2018, they found it in kids as young as 3 years of age. And it absolutely goes to adults. 10% of those in my study started at 18 or later.
10%, you said?
Mm-hmm.
So still, like, most people would start younger, but still a significant.
It's still a significant number to pay attention to. And those are just the adults that come in and admit to it. But since so many people don't assess for it, I mean, who knows? And then people can return to it, that they may have done it for a while as adolescents, then they stopped, maybe they did other stuff, and then they came back to it as adults. So there's all sorts of interesting things there, but it's in it's across all racial groups, it's across all age groups, all financial groups. It is an international epidemic, and that's not an exaggeration.
Yeah, and yet it's still kind of this dark corner of the room idea where that's not something that people talk about.
Yes. Yeah.
Hmm. And then because of that, because it is this taboo thing that leads to clinicians being uneducated or unaware, then what are some of the negative consequences of that, that trickle down to the patients?
Well, when clinicians are uneducated about it and treatment centers don't assess for it or know how to deal with it, it just reinforces the stigma. People usually aren't just going to come out and say, hey, this is something I'm going to do. It's something that has to be assessed for. It has to be talked about. There has to be a trust there. And when you don't have education, it's hard for you to feel comfortable in your own skin to talk about, to assess for it. And clients, especially if they've had poor treatment responses in the past where people have been judgmental, and I've had so many of those cases where clinicians have said the wrong thing, that they've had a bad attitude, they've been judgmental, condescending, and that's why, you know, they switch counselors or they just stay away from mental health for a long time until they're forced to get it again. But it, when I have these stories that come into me of practitioners that say the wrong thing, say it's for attention, say, well, why don't you just stop it? Just quit doing it. Something completely ineffective. Then it closes the client off. You know, why on earth would they then be open with you? Why would they then share? Because you just showed you don't understand it.
It's hard enough to make that decision to seek help without all of that. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so then you touched on earlier about the similarities between substance use and this. How can knowing those similarities, like in this context where a lot of people are dealing with substance use, how can, like, knowing what to do with that when you come across somebody who's also doing self-harm, how can that help treating the whole person?
Well, I think with all of these things, I'll say you can't focus solely on the behavior. You have to get to the core issues. And when I work with clients, I've developed what I call this tree model, and we're all about getting to the root system, the actual core stuff. Because whether it's substance or eating disorder or injury or gambling or porn, those are all symptoms. They're just symptoms of a deeper issue. And the concern I have is that so often we focus solely on a behavior, and you can get rid of that behavior, and then they're going to flip-flop to something else. And what people have talked with me about in the substance realm is that they will get sober from a substance, but now they're self-harming. And I've had plenty of clients that self-harmed and that stopped, and then maybe they started to experiment with substances because the core stuff wasn't addressed. And that's where I'd love to get into treatment centers and really help them understand some of the techniques that I use and really understand how everything is so interconnected. And the techniques really are applicable to whatever behavior may be present. But definitely someone can stop with substance and then they go to self-harm instead.
So let's get into what you're hoping that people get out of it. What would be some do's and don'ts for clinicians, therapists, that kind of thing, when it comes to addressing this issue with their patients?
First, never make assumptions. Always ask. Always be open. And assumptions of don't assume that it was a suicide. Don't assume they do it for attention. Don't assume that they must be psychotic and that's why they do it. Always ask, you know, what was your intent behind this? What was your desired effect? You know, what continues to keep you going and doing this? You know, and what would you like to see go differently? Yeah. A lot of times people actually know the answers. It's just no one ever asked them. And so ask, what is your perfect situation? What is it you desire to get out of treatment? Do you even want to work on this behavior? We can know something isn't healthy, but until the client is really at that spot where they understand it's not healthy and they have the desire to work on it, sometimes you're going to just be stuck. And that's where you have to have some of that patience and what I call the backdoor method. So when I work with my tree model, it's, you know what? We don't have to talk about so much the self-injury right now. Let's just look at all the things, you know, other things that might be going on in your life. And as we're dealing with all the core stuff, invariably the need to do the other behaviors starts to go away. And it's just been so consistent and have a 90% success rate with it.
With the tree model?
Yes, with the tree model, and that's 90% for the self-injury side, and it's 90% for just my general population clients.
Is there anything that you haven't said about the tree model that would help describe it? How does that work?
It's sort of, well, visualizing a tree, it's a really great picture, and the root system are the beliefs we have about ourselves. And obviously, when someone is doing harmful behaviors, low self-esteem is going to be a really big factor. Where does low self-esteem come from? Well, it comes from the beliefs we have about ourselves. And that's a very simplistic way of describing it. There's a lot more detail and nuances, but that's sort of the basics. And so we're going to get into that root system, because if you don't have a healthy root system, if all of those different beliefs aren't healed, you don't really have a good shot of having a healthy tree.
Hmm. Yeah. So what's maybe one or two things that you wish more clinicians understood about self-harm and SSI?
First and foremost, that it's treatable. It's completely a treatable behavior. And yes, you do have to have the motivation of the client, because if the client's not motivated, again, you're sort of, stuck at times. But it's 100% treatable behavior. There is absolutely hope. There's help, there's solutions out there. And that, too, it's much more common than what most clinicians think. And because of that, we really have to start assessing. We really need to start those discussions. We need to start the education programs, because so many people are dismissive of it. I've had parents that said, well, they're just experimenting. They'll grow out of it. You don't know that.
And it's still, there's still something causing them to do
that,
even if it's a phase and they move on to something else.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, well, why would you want your kid to move on to something else? Wouldn't you want to deal with whatever this issue, trigger, et cetera, is? But it's also clinicians, I would want them to just learn to start to be comfortable with what I sometimes call is the NSSI or the SI question, the S words. Be comfortable talking about suicide. Be comfortable talking about self-injury. That's just part of our field. And it's not saying you have to treat it, but you have to be comfortable enough to ask about it and assess for it. And then you can always refer out. But you have to do your due diligence, your ethical responsibility to do those assessments.
Yeah, because if you don't ask, then maybe no one else will.
Precisely.
Yeah. All right. Well, just to wrap up, I know everyone who works in this profession, it can be hard at times, it can be heavy at times, especially dealing with, suicide, self-injury, but people keep getting up and fighting this fight. Could you end by kind of summing up why this mission is so important to you?
It was something I stumbled into 20 years ago, and it's just, different passions end up for different people. This is absolutely my passion, and I've seen the success. I've not, healed every person that I've worked with. No clinician can say that. And sometimes it's about the right fit, but those that have gotten better, when I've seen some of the extremely difficult cases, and I see them graduating from high school, I see them going to college and getting married, I see them hitting their sobriety dates of years and years, and it's inspiring, and to me, it's a completely preventable behavior, and I sort of have the nickname of I'm a saver of lives and limbs, and I want to continue doing that and eradicate self-injury.
Van is a speaker, author, and licensed counselor with over 20 years of experience studying and treating non-suicidal self-injury. You can find more resources about NSSI from Lori on her website at lorivancounseling.com. And if you or someone you know needs immediate assistance related to self-injury, you can get access to 24-hour help via text by visiting crisistextline.org/self-harm. As always, this podcast is powered by Foundations Recovery Network and produced, written, and edited by me, David Kondos. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word and share it with someone else who might enjoy it as well. Thank you for listening, and I hope to see you right back here for the next episode of Recovery Unscripted.